You are walking along the street and saying to Richard Chamberlain Tchaikovsky, well, we'll go on a long train journey, we'll have a nightcap and we'll have a good night's sleep. Cut to you glugging back the champagne in that railway carriage that then begins rocking around all over the place.
Well, I personally, but it wasn't something that I felt when we were actually shooting, but when you saw the films all put together, there always did seem to me to be an intensely musical element. I don't just mean the sound, I mean the kind of rhythms and the colorations of the scenes actually playing out. But we shot that scene and he realized he needed another shot, so he said to me, they'd built this railway carriage. And we had to come back, and it was me rolling naked on the floor of the railway carriage, and the cameraman and the operator were in the luggage rack, and I'm rolling around. And he was somewhere, Ken was somewhere. And he'd been playing music, and he said, shall I cut the music? So I said, no, don't cut the music. I said, no, I need that. That's great, because the carriage was being manually rocked. And I can't remember the piece. I mean, Mark said he thought it was from The Fiery Angel.
I thought it was Prokofiev,
I can't remember that. But as I said, you know, if I'd been humming Gershwin, he'd have played Gershwin for me if that had been really what he wanted. But it was, there I am rolling around. The first thing that happened was all the champagne bottles and the glass and the thing crash onto me. Oh, he says, she's fine, she's not bleeding much. Come on, she's not bleeding, it'll never show. So the next thing is there was some beautiful period luggage on the other luggage rack, which was metal, hat boxes. They're the next thing, bang, onto me. The bruises won't show, come on. So we get to the third time, and the next moment is the cameraman is sitting in my lap, and he said to me, I'm a married man. Quite what he thought I was going to do, I don't know, but... But that again, I mean, the kind of rocking of the carriage backwards and forwards, yes, there was a musical element to that.
He saw an overlap between the world of the contemporary rock music of the 1970s and the classical composer. So sort of continuity between those two things.
He absolutely did. I mean, if you look at something like Tommy, which pretty much defined what we now think of as the pop video, what he did was he listened to that piece of music, which, oddly enough, the story of Tommy chimed very much with the story that he'd been writing anyway about false idolatry, which was always a big theme of his. You see it in many of his films. And he listened to it and responded to that in exactly the same way that he'd responded to the classical music that had inspired him before. And what's extraordinary about Tommy is it's like the birth of the rock video. It comes fully formed. There's no sense in Tommy that somebody's discovering a new... It's just like, this is it. And it's amazing now when you look at so much MTV and you just go, OK, that's a shot from Tommy, that's a shot from Listomania, that's a shot from... I mean, literally, in those two films, he defined what would then, you know, 30 years later, would still be ringing true. And I think one of the reasons is that he didn't see, this is classical music, this is serious, this is rock music, it's serious. I mean, obviously, Pete Townsend is a very versatile musician anyway, and he and Pete Townsend did get on very, very well. But he didn't see there as being a gap between the two things. They were all part of a continuum. And I think that also feeds into the fact that, you know, later in life he was making his short films, his experimental short films, and one of the things he was doing at one point was making a film in which he was trying to document all the verses of the sea shanty, "'Twas on the Good Ship Venus." This was a great passion for him. He loved sea shanties. They were all part and parcel of the same thing. It's all music. It's all music, no matter what you call it, rock, pop, classical. It's all music.
His career does have a strange sort of symmetry to it, doesn't it? He makes his experimental, his student films. He makes films in Britain. He goes to Hollywood. He comes back. He makes films here again. And then in the last few years of his life, he's making films sort of out of the shed, isn't he? I mean, are we wrong to see this as a story of a rise and fall? Is that too simple a way of looking at it?
I think it is somewhat too simplistic. I mean, the real point of that story is... It is to the undying shame of the British film industry that he was making films in a shed at the bottom of his garden, and the way that, in a sense, he has almost been sidelined. The man who transformed the British film industry, in my view. I mean, up until Ken came along, really, we were still stuck with that terrible, parochial, narrow vision of, I think in a way, a narrow vision of the country, but certainly a narrow view of what film was all about. And he absolutely exploded that. And people you know, jumped on that bandwagon for a time, but in a way, the fact that he was making films in the shed in his bottom of his garden, it goes back to the point I was making earlier, that terrible, terrible burden of being whipped by your genius, which he was.
But did he really mind being in the shed, Mark? I mean, I remember going down to interview him, and he spoke of his studio years almost as a sort of blip, and he said he hadn't enjoyed... He was making a film called Lion's Mouth, yeah. A sort of a kind of musical biopic of the rector of Stewkey, a sort of scandalous figure of the 1920s and 30s, and he said he hadn't enjoyed himself as much since he made Amelia and the Angel, that very early experimental film.
The peculiar thing is, when we were working on the restoration of The Devils, the uncut version of which still has not been released by Warners, because even after all these years, they still consider it too controversial, too fiery for public consumption. But even when he was doing that, he was making what he referred to as his garagiste films. He said, I'm a garagiste, I make films in my garage. And what he loved about it was the control. Not having to do the tap dancing around the producers, not having to fight the battles, not having to... He felt like that was a great freedom. And I think he genuinely enjoyed that work and produced some extraordinary work during that period as much as he enjoyed doing anything else. I completely agree with Glenda that it is outrageous the way that the British film industry didn't show him the respect it should have done. I mean, Fellini once described himself, to Ken, in fact, he said, here in Italy, they call me the Italian Ken Russell.
Absolutely.
You know, if Fellini was making films in his garage, they'd be having film festivals for it.
Absolutely.
They'd be, you know, celebrating him as the great maestro. Only here could... It wasn't that Ken was making films in his garage. It was that anybody didn't think that's the most brilliant thing and we must all see what he's been doing because it's Ken Russell.
What would the world have been like if Ken Russell had never been in it? What has he bequeathed us?
Well, I think Glenda is absolutely right that he transformed the British film industry. You know, he called it one of his books, you know, British Picture, and it was a reference to something his mother would say. Is it a British picture? Meaning, you know, is it small and about people making tea? And,
exactly.
And he made movies that were classically not British. And they were, you know, as you were saying, the big canvas, the big picture. So I think he gave us that. He had the air of a star as a director. I mean, people nowadays... There's a famous truism, apparently, that if you ask people to name movie stars, they can do it. But if you ask them to name movie directors, they go Steven Spielberg, Stanley Kubrick, Alfred Hitchcock. He was one of those flamboyant directors who you knew, you recognised his vision. He had, everything he touched had his touch on it. And I think even more than that, and I do think this is his enduring legacy, he was somebody who believed absolutely in the power of the work. And no matter what criticism was thrown at him, no matter what snipes were thrown at him by the critical establishment, no matter what financial difficulties he may have had, he never, ever, ever lost faith in the truth of the work. He passionately believed in his films and he passionately believed in cinema. And, I mean, I think that's his enduring legacy. He was an artist. He
Absolutely.
Was an artist working in an industry.
Absolutely. And he never cheated. And he never lied, and he struggled, as all great artists do, to tell the truth in a medium which is quite difficult to tell the truth in quite often. And I go back to the point I was making earlier. I mean, of his BBC films, as I've said, my favourite is Isadora. I think Vivian Pickles is absolutely superb in it, but it's a superb film because it tells the truth about what it's like to be a performing artist, because he cuts away all the fantasy and all the romanticism. And he does that, I think, in all his films. And they are not only informed by the passion for the work, but something which I don't think has been recognized sufficiently in him. He was passionate about man's inhumanity to man. He was absolutely apoplectic about how dreadful we can be to each other. And that is in all his films somewhere.
And if I may add to that, that is at the core of The Devils,
absolutely.
Which was given a terrible run, but is, as far as he's concerned, a film about exactly that
absolutely.
Subject.
Absolutely.
Mark Kermode, Glenda Jackson, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Matthew Sweet presented this evening's Proms literary event on the work of director Ken Russell, and the producer was Gavin Hurd. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. I'm Andrew McGregor, live at the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's visit from the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra and its chief conductor, Vasily Petrenko, with whom they've been making something of a speciality of Shostakovich's symphonies, on disc and in concert. Now, the whole of the second half of the Prom is taken up with Shostakovich's 10th symphony, the first of the cycle to emerge after Joseph Stalin's death in 1953, and for many commentators, its four movements are inescapably associated with Shostakovich's experience of the Stalin years, the terrors and the purges. But what about Petrenko? Like Shostakovich, he was born, brought up and studied in Leningrad.
Yes, I always felt very close to his music. It's in my veins, it's in my blood, and when I'm conducting it, and I'm conducting it a lot now on the West, I always have a pictures in my imagination of Leningrad as it's been by then. Of course, the city's changed now in a good side because it's cleaner, safer, etc. But it's lost its character a little bit. And all those periods in the history, all throughout the life of Shostakovich, are very fascinating. And how he had written the symphonies and had written basically autobiopic over 60 years. It's fascinating and it's absolutely unprecedented.
And when it comes to the cycle of the symphonies, what do you think is the place of the 10th symphony, musically speaking? It's a very considerable moment in the cycle.
It is. It's one of the most popular symphonies in the world. It's one of the most playable symphonies. And, of course, it's a great music and one of the symphonies which shaped in a very fascinating way. So you can see the architecture of the symphony clearly done. There's similarity in the structure of the movements. There's similarity in the relations between the themes, between the subjects, between first and third movement, for instance. The language is very different. Very meditative first movement and very grotesque, sardonic third movement. But relation between the themes are nearly the same. And the shape, the amount of time spent on exploration of one theme or another. It's also have fantastic orchestral colorings. There's some things which he found in this symphony which never happened before. Technique of the strings playing. It's a symphony which has probably most down bows alongside of all his symphonies. And they're quite fast passages which he insisted to play down bow because he wanted the special sound.
And what about this orchestra? Are they playing like Russians yet?
Of course they do. You know, what I like in Liverpool is that they do have some influence of Russian character, of course. But they also have the British character, of course. And combination of two, that's something very unique. I must say, in many ways, the British passion in the character is very close to the Russian passion in the character. It has no boundaries when it goes to the point. But it has its discipline, sometimes more than the Russian orchestra. It has its nobility, which also not always happened in the Russian orchestra. So I would say it's a combination of two countries or two characters from different countries, which makes it very unique.
Vasily Petrenko on his favourite Russian orchestra in the UK, the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic, which is on stage at the Royal Albert Hall right now. And here he comes, Petrenko, who's been reminding them all earlier today of life in Leningrad in the 1950s. And he's about to conduct Shostakovich's 10th symphony. Shostakovich's personal musical signature, DSCH, stamped defiantly all over the end of his Symphony No. 10 from 1953. Shostakovich perhaps forcefully making the point that for all the fear, the criticism, the persecution and the desolation that opens that last movement, he won, he outlived the dictator Stalin. The Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra, led this evening by Thelma Handy, conducted by Chief Conductor Vasily Petrenko. Walking back onto the platform to the cheers of the promenaders and the applause of his own orchestra. Music stands being tapped enthusiastically. And Petrenko gets the brass section to stand. And then timpanist Neil Hitt. His career chose him, I think. Principal horn player Timothy Jackson. The rest of the horn section now taking their call. Bassoonist Alan Pendlebury. Oboist Jonathan Small. Korongo player Rachel Pankhurst all getting their turn in the spotlight. The clarinet section led by Catherine Lacey. Flautists and piccolo player Cormac Henry and Fiona Patterson. And a kiss for Thelma Handy leading the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra. Petrenko's, well, he's a tall man, long arms, very fluid gestures and then fluid stick technique as well. He has really supple wrists and the fingers of his left hand are constantly communicating to the players. And balletic poise on the rostrum. It's probably all those years conducting the ballet in St. Petersburg. I read somewhere that he reckons he's conducted Swan Lake 150 times or thereabouts, although he might have been exaggerating for effect. Well, we've had three works this evening spanning almost a century, each composer in their way touched by conflict. The Delius's escaping their French home ahead of the German army in 1915. Shostakovich, silenced as a symphonist by Stalin's post-war terror, finding his voice after the dictator's death. And Sir Peter Maxwell Davis's Ninth Symphony, coloured by his reaction to military intervention in the Middle East. A fascinating range of sounds and ideas, from Max in Italy to Shostakovich in Leningrad. And as Vasily Petrenko bows low to the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall, the next combination of name and place is James Jolly back in Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Andrew. That was Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Tuesday, the 4th of September at 2 in the afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. We return to the Royal Albert Hall for our next prom tomorrow night when we've a performance of Peter Grimes by Benjamin Britten with soloists and the forces of English National Opera conducted by Edward Gardner. The performance begins at 7 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Searing psychological drama, Peter Grimes.
Now's our chance. The whole sea's boiling. Get the nets. Come, boy.
A work that established a new tradition in English opera and an acclaimed ENO production that's been playing to packed houses since 2009.
We're going to sea.
Britten's Peter Grimes from the BBC Proms. Tomorrow night on BBC Radio 3 from 7 o'clock.
Now, we've not had any vocal music this evening, so I thought I'd put that to rights before our 10 o'clock feature with a group of songs by someone who was perhaps one of the greatest influences on the music of one of the composers we've heard this evening, Frederick Delius. The composer in question is Edvard Grieg, and we're going to hear his Hjertets Melodia, or Melodies of the Heart. It's a quartet of songs, Two Brown Eyes, A Poet's Heart, the very famous I Love You, and My Thoughts Are Like a Mighty Mountain. The singers, Katarina Karneus.
Dear Flamets, kneel thou bow
The Four Melodies of the Heart by Edvard Grieg. The singer was Katerina Karnaeus, and Julius Drake played the piano. And tomorrow afternoon, on Afternoon on Three from 2 o'clock, you can hear a repeat of the Proms performance from a couple of Sundays ago of Schoenberg's Gurrelieder, in which Katerina Karnaeus sang the Wood Dove, and she was joined by Simon O'Neill, Angela Danoka, Neil Davis, Jeffrey Lloyd Roberts and Wolfgang Schoener. The forces of the BBC, expanded BBC Symphony Orchestra and Choruses, is conducted by Jukka-Pekka Saraste. That's 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Now, here's a few words from Andrew McGregor about one of the proms next week.
A composer renowned for choral music that's winning ever wider audiences. On BBC Radio 3, Eric Whittaker makes his proms debut in the late-night showcase for which the BBC singers join forces with his own vocal ensemble. The programme includes Whittaker's new work inspired by the Olympic motto, Citius Altius Fortius, faster, higher, stronger. Eric Whittaker at the BBC Proms, on Radio 3 this Wednesday night at 10:15.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 10 o'clock. Now, walking with attitude. Psychogeography was invented by the French situationists in the 1950s. But in recent years, the word has started turning up in style magazines and colour supplements. But what does it mean? Novelist and travel writer Ian Marchant tries to find out.
On the 6th of March 1956, the situationist Guy Debord and Gil Volman came wandering through the 11th arrondissement in search of psychogeographical enlightenment, trying to get lost, trying to defamiliarise themselves with their own city. This is an area that they found repulsively petty bourgeois. On one level, they were just two drunk avant-garde French artists wandering about from bar to bar. On another level, this project has come to be seen as revolutionary, as a completely new way of addressing the city. As a personal project, you reinvent yourself at the same time as the city is reinvented around you. And this, apparently, is psychogeography. Whoa! Red light. Came very close to ending up in a Parisian hospital there. Which would have been a sort of way of getting lost, I guess. For several years now, psychogeography has been a word worth dropping into conversation if you want to impress with your cultural street smarts. More interesting than the oxbow lakes of your own school geography, and more hip than the human geography your own kids do, such as studying footfalls in shopping centres, psychogeography sounds edgy, which it might be if you could work out what it was. It was invented by situationist Guy Debord, and in Paris, I spoke to Debord's biographer, Andrew Hussey.
Debord said that the word came to him when he'd taken some hashish, and he was wandering through the Jardin des Plantes, and he was so stoned that he couldn't find his way out, so he decided to stay in the park and explore its inner recesses. So it was a journey into the inner mind, as well as the city.
He called it pleasingly vague. Is it too vague? Does it have any meaning at all, do you think?
It does have a meaning. And the idea is that the city, as you wander through it, is endlessly changing as you penetrate the different levels of atmosphere and as those atmospheres have an effect on you. Now, not all of those atmospheres are pleasant. They can be awe, they can be boredom, they can be melancholy. So the vagueness is actually to do with the endlessly fluid nature of the city, which is always moving.
So this is the Rue Oberkampf, and we're heading across the 11th arrondissement, Jolly and the producer and I. We're not exactly lost. They were lost. We, weirdly, are following in their footsteps. There are lingerie shops, which is always welcome. But is it, I don't know if my psyche's being changed, that's the thing. That's one of the things I simply don't understand. Who has sufficient access to their consciousness to say, oh, I'm feeling mordant, or, you know, lachrymose or something, as opposed to, oh, I've never been here before. Debord calls somewhere depressingly picturesque, and I find this quite picturesque. Just exactly the sort of charmant little area that you'd boast to your friends about when you go home and say, oh, I don't know if you know the 11th arrondissement. It's marvellous. We found the Rue Oberkamp. So it seemed to them, I guess, deeply inauthentic. Whereas to an English bloke, it seems deeply authentically Parisian.
What the Situationists believed was that we are imprisoned in what they call the society of the spectacle. And where we're standing right here, if I just turn to my left, you can see all the right bank, which is commodity, commerce, the spectacle of consumerism, and they hated all of that. And what they wanted to do is develop techniques, strategies, situations, which were ways of resisting the control of the spectacle in our lives. And if I turn to the right, which actually I'm pointing to the left bank, that was the playground for the Situationists, where they practiced this thing called psychogeography.
So what is the spectacle then?
Guy Debord says that everything that once was truly lived has now moved away into representation. And if you think about it, that's true, that we live in a society where we're surrounded by more images, more visual culture than ever before. Now, the idea of the spectacle can be traced back to Paris in the 1850s, when Baron Haussmann reinvented the city with the great boulevards. This was the first modern designer city in the world. You could walk the boulevards and consume with your eyes the spectacle of things that you might want to buy, which could range from a newfangled kettle to a prostitute. Now, the flaneur, the man who wandered through the city in that way, was consuming the spectacle in that way. The Situationists kind of turned that on its head, because what they wanted to do was create a way of wandering through the city, the dérive, which means in French the drift, in which you were led by your own unconscious desires rather than desires that were given to you by capitalist economics.
Walking up the Rue Oberkampf, the first thing they saw that they liked was at 160, Delicatessen Provision A Breton.
Bonjour.
What's now at 160 Rue Oberkampf is a phone shop called Phonio. And in a way, the phony is what Debord meant by the spectacle, that the spectacle was phony. Was authenticity to do with the working class? I mean, on the dérives, did they meet people? Were they engaging with people?
I think what Debord was interested in was not so much the working class, and he wasn't somebody who was actually going to do a lot of work himself, but what the French historian Louis Chevalier calls les classes dangereuses, the dangerous classes. Revolution is not going to come from the working class, that's all finished, but from the dangerous classes, the outlaws, the sexual transgressors, the misfits, the drunks, the anarchists.
What are we looking for?
I suppose we're looking for dangerous lowlifes like this gentleman here, who's just but a kind of old tramp whose head is covered in open sores and a couple of packs of the French equivalent of special brew. And we have turned the corner and there are homeless people and Middle Eastern shops and an abandoned lavatory on the street. But it's still very nice.
They would find themselves in the company of refugees from the Spanish Civil War in a bar in Aubervilliers. They'd find themselves in a place where drugs were sold by Algerians in the 1950s.
Lads playing football. Bonjour.
On passe à la télé?
Ah, non.
C'est la radio.
La radio, oui. Radio Angleterre. I can't really speak French. It's the most French I've ever used. And it doesn't go anywhere, it goes to a hotel. So, you know, we've come out of a dodgy old bit and back into somewhere that one can only describe as repulsively petty bourgeois. Did we meet any dangerous people? I suppose there were some dodgy-looking characters. Did we try and buy hashish or opium off them? Not really. Should we have done in order to do the authentic thing? Perhaps we should go back. I think the license payers might draw the line. Anyway, here we are, Avenue Simon Bolivar. Wonder where we go next. The Situationists didn't leave a lot of psychogeographic writing behind, and what they did sometimes seems a bit, well, pedestrian. Debord did produce a couple of psychogeographic maps where he cut up the map of Paris and stuck it back together in ways that represented psychogeographic reality. I'm a travel writer. I guess I've been trying to track down what's the difference between what a travel writer does and psychogeography, given that I go to places that I haven't been before, I kind of get lost, I meet people I haven't met before, I try to find out about the place, and I'm an old punk rocker.
I think it hits on something really important here, because What it's all about, I think, is atmosphere, isn't it? It's about the, if you like, the politics of atmosphere and, you know, the dead eve, psychogeography. It's about trying to find atmospheres in the city and then trying to understand what they mean. And you can do that, you know, from Paris to Wigan. You know, there's all meanings to be uncovered in the city. And there's a great book by the Spanish novelist Juan Goiti Solo called Paisajes Después de la Tierra, Landscapes After the Battle, in which, and he borrows this from Guy Debord, everybody wakes up in Paris one day to find that the whole of the Roman alphabet has been replaced by Arabic. And of course, the people who live in Paris, the Parisians, cannot understand the city that they live in. Yeah. The only people who can understand it are the bin men, the people working in low-grade jobs, the dangerous classes, the Arabic readers. The meaning of the city is flipped over. And this is what the maps were about for Guy Debord. They're about flipping over into different types of experience, which could be disorientating, it could be alienating, it could be exhilarating. But it was about reinventing a sense of place.
We've arrived at the Place de Bataille, Stalingrad, and here's the curve of the overhead metro line, which they describe as being charming. This is the impressive rotunda, and they call this a psycho-geographical hub. And although they went on from here, we're probably going to have to finish here, especially since the Situationist on their derive says, as darkness descends, they finally decide to put an end to a dérive that they deem to be of little interest as such. But there, we've done it. We've followed in the footsteps of Debord and Volman. And I'm pleased to say that over there by the Canal Martin, there's a café bar, and this is very important because Debord and Volman, frankly, were drunk for the whole of their dérive, and we've come to the end of our dérive, and I'm not saying that we're going to get drunk, but perhaps we could go and get a nice cup of tea.
There is a kind of dandyish quality to the drift, the Situationist's act of wandering around like gentlemen of leisure.
Alastair Bonnet, Professor of Geography at Newcastle University.
I think what is interesting about psychogeography over the years is it has moved on. It's moved away from this urban avant-garde groupuscule to become something much more important and engaged with a much wider constituency of people. So I tend to look at psychogeography as having its backstory, essentially, with the French post-war avant-garde. But then really coming alive, really quite recently, from the 1990s onwards.
What brings it back to life, do you think?
Well, I think there's two reasons.
Yeah.
I think the first one is that the glamour of distance has faded and travel to distant locales has become almost banal. And what that means is that the place around the corner, ordinary landscapes, have gained some of the glamour. That's one reason, but I think there's another, and that is the profound dissatisfaction that many people feel with the contemporary city, a sense that the non-place urban realms that many of us live in are just not humanly satisfying. So it's no wonder that people are searching for adventure, for the mysterious, for connection. And they are using some of the techniques of psychogeography, but also going way beyond it to turn their ordinary landscapes into spaces of adventure.
If Paris was the centre of the first wave, the golden age of psychogeography, the second wave from the 1980s onwards was in London. The central figures were writers Ian Sinclair and Will Self. Sinclair started off not with politics but fiction, and his novel Lud Heat was hugely influential for the coming new wave of psychogeographers.
I was working as a gardener in Limehouse and Wapping and along the river, and just because I was cutting grass in Hawksmoor churches, you could see in this what was pretty much a derelict kind of landscape at that time. These great block churches were immense presences, and they seemed to me to connect, and there were lines and patterns that grew out from that. And so combining a kind of work diary of what it was like to work as a labourer through the area with speculations about these churches and about patterns of energy in a city created a kind of bouillabaisse of a form, which I think had some kind of influence on some of the people who later became psychogeographers. And it was only years later that I dropped the term psychogeography into the more documentary works I was doing, because it seemed very appropriate to that political moment. This was a very useful sort of satiric tool at the beginning of a book called Lights Out for the Territory, where I start to actually do very specific walks, a V sign across London, recording graffiti that can only be described as a psychogeographic exercise.
Sinclair became seen as the silverback of Silver Age psychogeography, but its writer Will Self, who popularised the term, with a column in The Independent called Psychogeography.
Sinclair comes to it, it seems to me, with the fully blown sensibility of the kind of English romantic mystic, albeit in a rather straight-laced form, our kind of contemporary William Blake in some way. You know, he's constantly striding out and looking down to the Clerkenwell Road and seeing dark satanic mills, and he's willing to give headspace to concepts like ley lines or lines of force or kind of mystic underbelly to the urban experience that I don't really click into in that way. I came at it from a different angle. I grew up in a walking household. My father was a big walker, but I kind of rather lost that during the drug taking and the drinking years, and was a big car driver. And what I was preoccupied by was liminal parts of city, the kind of strange hinterland of cities where they kind of fade into the countryside, really kind of preoccupied me a lot in my 20s and 30s. And I mean, I can remember going out in the 1980s to places like the Isle of Grain and kind of being quite preoccupied by these, but having no real acquaintance with the literature or any of the theoretical superstructure at all, just having a kind of visceral and sentimental feel for these places. You know, ideally, what I like to do, with, I think, appropriate homage to Sinclair, you know, the thing I've mostly done over the last decade has been these kind of radial walks out from the centre of London for kind of 60, 100, 120 miles into the hinterland of the city, so that I can take these kind of biopsies or tissue samples or apprehend the stratigraphy of the urban, the suburban, the liminal, and then the countryside itself.
You talk about doing long urban walks, and I guess I've hung about on suburban stations in various states of intoxication. Could you remember when doing long urban walks or hanging about on suburban stations became psychogeography? Can you sort of pin down when?
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, if you look back, and Sinclair is undoubtedly the pivotal figure, I don't think I started to hear the term bandied about really a lot until the late 90s.
The word has become so common in certain circles that some putative psychogeographers have become embarrassed by it. One of them is Will Self's friend and collaborator, Nick Papadimitriou. He's writing a book about his own North London edgelands.
We're in Edgware, outside the Broadwalk shopping centre, with Nick Papadimitriou. And we're going on a walk. Are we going on a derive, would you say?
Unfortunately, it's not a derive because I know precisely where we'll be going, although you don't. I believe a derive is a walk wherein you get lost.
So, are you a psychogeographer?
I have no idea. Some people call me a psychogeographer, and people who call themselves psychogeographers incline towards being my friend, but I tend to think of myself as more as a deep topographer.
I like the line, some of my best friends are psychogeographers.
They think they're my friends, I'm not so sure myself.
So, we're going to walk. Where are you taking us?
I'm taking you out of what might pass as being the dullest sort of suburbia, but the main purpose of the walk today is to show you the transition from what could be taken as the northern edge of London onto the Scarp, which is the project I'm covering in my book of the same name, Scarp, in order to show you how this long line of hills does actually exist and isn't just a figment of my imagination, despite the fact that it has no cultural presence whatsoever. Unfortunately, the North Middlesex South Hertfordshire Tertiary Escarpment is overshadowed by...
It's a rubbish name, in fairness.
Well, I beg your pardon, Ian. I think there's something destabilising about thinking of a place within walking distance of the northern reaches of London as having such a grand geological title. I really object to your comment.
Nick started deep topography as a kind of personal therapy.
I found when I started walking in the late 80s that I was having a magnitude of experience that I couldn't find any reference to in most of the ramblers' guides and the like that I turned to in order to find identification. So I figured that I was either going through something that was entirely new or that it was just something that people hadn't been able to or hadn't felt was important enough to describe. And I put it to myself that it was my job to try and describe that. So as a writer, that's the sort of thing I try and do. And it's very difficult. I'm inventing new ways of expressing landscape as I go along.
Oh, no. Wow. Ooh. Is this the North Circular?
No, it's the A41T Watford Bypass. Oh. And that's Edgware Bury Lane. It's beginning to run uphill. You can see that we've been climbing steadily for about half a mile now, and we've attained a bit of a height, and we're going to get higher. And we're just about to enter an area of green belt, albeit green belt that's intersected by motorways and railway lines and arterial roads.
Because we've come to the exact moment where the pavement has stopped on one side of the road, and this side of the road suddenly looks kind of rural.
Well, this is the edge of London.
Do you know what? I really believe you. It looks like it. It feels like it. It's a really fascinating feeling.
Further up the hill, we'll come to Clay Lane. There were tramp murders up there in the 1930s. And further down the hill, Daniel Raven lived, who murdered his parents-in-law. There were plenty of other murders in the area as well.
Yeah. It seems to me sometimes, if psychogeography, one of the ways it differs from local history, perhaps, is it's very interested in the dark side.
Well, as it happens, I wrote a book called Foul Deeds and Suspicious Deaths in Barnet, Hendon and Finchley for Pen and Sword. That was my first book. I think psychogeography is an attempt to destabilise normalcy. And one of the ways that you can relish doing that in a suburb is to point out that that house over there was the scene of a murder. Specific things that make up the identity of places and add to their presence if you know about them. I mean, I happen to know when I walked up here one time about 10 years ago, I accidentally trod on a beetle that was crossing the road. And yeah. I nearly always think about that when I walk up here, because that's kind of a big event for the beetle.
Nick calls this hyperparticularity. He knew the names of the ducks in the farmyards. Where there weren't names for features of scarp, he had invented them.
I'm a bit puffed up. We've clearly walked up something. How much do you think scarp is a product of your imagination?
Scarp tends to fade and then reconcretize for me. Sometimes I can't see it. Sometimes I wonder if it's coherent enough an entity to justify writing a book about it.
You're walking in this landscape, if you like, for a purpose, with attitude. You're a punk walker. And I wondered, you know, the extent to which you bring your imagination to play on the landscape. You are, to some extent, making this landscape up as a deep topographer.
I'm ill-equipped to define the difference between reality and imagination, I must admit.
As we reached the top of Scarp, Nick knew a shortcut through the woods to where we could get a bus back to Edgware.
It should take us into the churchyard. I've got my phone so we can get rescue services.
That's the way we came from.
I have no idea. Right way. Track to the church, please. We are straightforwardly lost.
I got us lost.
Okay.
And we hoped that there was a track down towards the church.
It's a very long walk. You come all the way down there, but it's private property.
Oh.
So you're not allowed down there. So I'll cut you out this door here.
That's
and
really kind.
And then get to the end and you'll see a massive gate. Yep. Turn right and the church is just there.
Thank you.
We're making a documentary for Radio 3.
So we ended up with a proper Debord East derive after all. One man who celebrates and has reinvented situationist psychogeography is the artist, filmmaker, writer and pamphleteer Stuart Holme. He read Ian Sinclair, was influenced by him and ended up influencing him back.
Sinclair couldn't believe it when he was sent a pile of my books and wanted to meet me. And obviously when I met him, I gave him a lot of bumf written by various people. Me and also a friend of mine called Richard Essex, who revived the London Psychogeographical Association.
We need a bit of backstory here. The London Psychogeographical Association never really existed. It was just a name dreamt up by the British Situationist artist Ralph Rumney in 1957. And as soon as it was created, it was merged into the Situationist International and ceased to exist. Back to Stuart Home and his friend Richard Essex.
He'd been living out on the Isle of Dogs and became convinced that the pyramid at the top of Canary Wharf was a virtual triangle, and there was this huge ley line that ran through the whole of the British Isles that went through there. So Ian was very taken with this material, what he was doing. You could call psychogeography in a certain respect anyway, but started using the term and picking up on it.
Yeah. So are you the London Psychogeographical Association, or is there such a thing?
Yes, there was such a thing, but I'm not it. There was a bit of confusion because Ian didn't realise that all the material I gave him wasn't by me, so he wrote about it as being mine. I mean, he understands the score now, but there was an initial confusion. So a lot of people then thought I was the London Psychogeographical Association, which I'm not, but it was just one person. And I mean, the revival of that group, was this friend of mine, Richard Essex, who he'd been looking at De Boer's writing. When he saw that De Boer said that the only useful form of theory or knowledge was an unacceptable theory, he thought, ah, the occult. So he'd kind of plug the idea of psychogeography into ley lines.
Who is this mysterious Richard Essex, friend of Stuart Home? It turns out to be a pseudonym, we think, for Fabian Tompsett, self-described cultural worker. Ian Sinclair sees Stuart and Fabian as situationist wannabes.
I think very much this second wave of psychogeography was very much to do with radical nostalgia. Fabian and Stuart Home, both of them, were nostalgic for sort of cultural moments that they'd missed, which was glamorous. So they gave themselves honorary membership of the Situationists, and the way of becoming part of it was to recycle it or Xerox it. And it was radical in the sense that it was picking up on something that was out of the common parlance at that moment and giving it a way of directly addressing specifics of a BNP councillor being voted in Tower Hamlets, and so you take his house and you blast these psychogeographic paths or ley lines through that house, and you summon people down to the top of Greenwich Hill to enact a magical working against Prince Charles or whatever it is that you do. It had a kind of either genuinely radical or kind of cod radical aspect to it.
It's been described as magical Marxism. Alastair Bonnet, Professor of Real Geography at Newcastle, was a collaborator with Fabian Tompsett.
They, in a way, often script psychogeography as an elaborate game, almost a set of hoaxes. The interest in the occult that you find in the London Psychogeographical Association really pushed the boundaries, tracing ley lines between sites of class power. Now, one could look at this just as a form of play, but one can also look at it in terms of Marx's explanation of the fetishistic character of capitalism. In a way, the magico-Marxists were looking at capitalism as a dark religion in which fetishism has been developed and expanded, not just into the commodity world, but across the field of power relations. And these metaphors are taken literally within magico-Marxism, and so capitalism becomes this dark secret which only the occult operations of the magico-Marxists can open up. So there's something quite bewildering about that, something quite unnerving, and I never bought into it, but it seemed like a new way of doing politics. But at the end of the day, it also seemed to be making fun of class politics. It seemed to be making fun of revolutionary activity. To turn it into this sort of elaborate game is, in a sense, to undermine and subvert this tradition. So it's an interesting phenomenon in which the left and socialism no longer have a serious place within the political landscape, and therefore people can start playing games with it.
But do they believe any of it? Will Self?
Well, I think that's a very good point. I mean, I've stood with Ian by Greenwich Observatory and looked down on the Isle of Dogs and had him talk about some sort of cosmological feng shui that was terminally disrupted by the construction of Canary Wharf, and you really can't tell, even when you're standing right next to him, the extent to which he actually believes this. In a way, I have to say, I really hope he does, because otherwise it becomes a bit of a shtick, doesn't it?
But could it be a sort of situationist playfulness?
I suppose so, but, you know, as Montaigne says, mistrust a man who takes games too seriously. It means he doesn't take life seriously enough, you know, I mean. And this stuff is kind of serious, actually. It is serious, the way that public space is eroded, the way in which the physicality of your environment becomes wound round by razor wire and obliterated.